The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of
auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you
to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at
imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1979, China introduced its one-child policy to slow the country's explosive population growth. An estimated 400 million births were prevented by that policy. That opponents say led to forced abortions, underreported female births, and a gender imbalance. It remained controversial until late last month when the government announced that couples would be allowed to have two children. Human Rights Watch says the new policy does not mean China's reproductive freedom issues have been solved. Family planning is still state-monitored, and sex ed is rarely taught. Adam Minter is a writer based in Asia who's authored a series of op-eds on the policy change, one advocating that China overcome some bureaucratic and cultural barriers and improve that record. We reached him in Ningbo, China, via Skype. The line is a little cloudy. Adam, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Yeah, pleasure to be here.
Well, Adam, I mentioned that Human Rights Watch is not very impressed with the new policy, but your op-ed in Bloomberg View says it is a win for human rights. What makes this a step in the right direction?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's the one-child policy has always been very complicated and a little bit misunderstood. Even before this new policy was announced, 65% of Chinese families, mostly rural families, had the right to have second children, sometimes third children. So the majority of China's population actually had the right to have larger families than a single child. Who this policy really affects are urban families. You know, there's been an effort for 30 years now to keep the population of China's urban families small. So allowing them to go from one child to two child is really a victory. I mean, if you spend time in Chinese cities, it becomes noticeable when you see families. I mean, they're very small. So any opportunity to expand the rights to have the family that you want, in my opinion, is a victory for reproductive freedom. Is it a total victory? No, not at all. I mean, there will still be government intervention in families. Families will still be fined if they exceed the quotas. But, you know, now, at least the option is there to have more than one child and in the cities. And I think that's a great victory for reproductive freedom and human rights.
Given the decades of strict family planning and enforcement, how is sex and contraception education handled in China?
Well, that's the great irony. You know, for as much family planning policy as is made in China, there's actually very little family planning education in the schools. And that's a very, very big problem. A couple years ago, the United Nations Family Program with Tsinghua University, which is China's top university, kind of its Harvard, did a survey of Chinese young people to just get a sense of what their knowledge of contraception, sexual and reproductive health is. And what they came up with was really, really disturbing. Of 10,966 women between the ages of 15 and 25, only 4% had what the UNFP considered adequate knowledge of sexual and reproductive health. And it was even worse for those age 15 to 19. Those turned out to be the least knowledgeable. And that has real consequences. I mean, they're not getting, you know, very basic reproductive health information. And as a result, you see some really disturbing stats. So HIV infections among students age 15 and above grew about 24% between 2013 and 2014. And that's absolutely preventable. But because there isn't sex ed in the schools, because they're not getting, you know, even the very basics of what's going on, the chance to intervene with something like that isn't happening. But you also see a disturbing trend with contraception. There's just a study that was out a couple weeks ago. weeks ago. It's the first large-scale study of incidences of abortion amongst Chinese women. So of about 80,000 Chinese women who were surveyed in nearly 300 hospitals, 35% said they were having their first abortion, 37% said their second, and 29% were on a third or subsequent abortion. And most of them said that the reason they were there was because a failure of contraception, or 44% hadn't used contraception at all.
And so again, abortion used as a contraception method almost?
Exactly. It's very, very common in China. And you know, this isn't a pro-choice, pro-life argument. I mean, this is a tragedy. I mean, in China, abortion is legal and safe in a government hospital. But one of the things that happens is there's a lot of sort of pop-up commercial abortion clinics in China, and those are widely known to be not the cleanest, healthiest, safest situations. And so that's a real health risk to women, including a real sterilization risk if the procedure is not brought along safely. So this is a real big problem. And it's sort of one of the lesser discussed failures of China's so-called family planning policies over the last 30 years.
Adam, help us understand why the education is so poor.
From an American perspective, China is kind of an odd place. I mean, the surveys show that over 70% of Chinese, say they've had premarital sex, and yet premarital sex is something that's just not talked about publicly. China, in many ways, remains a very conservative, traditional society publicly. So even though, there's a lot going on behind closed doors, sort of the traditional conservative mindset in China, it's saying conservative is a little bit different than saying it in an American context, but the conservative mindset is that we do not discuss these matters publicly. And so putting them into the schools is something that many Chinese, I would say even, majority of an older generation, is deeply uncomfortable with. And so even though there's been discussions in China about the need for comprehensive sex education since the 1960s, and even though there was a directive from the government passed a couple years ago saying that this should happen, implementation has been almost non-existent.
The big news about sex in China is that its one-child policy was just recently reversed and now will allow two children. Well, despite those headlines, Adam Minter is with us. He's a writer based in Asia, and he says that China's sex and contraception education is dismally inadequate. It's so ironic, too, given that the state has inserted itself for decades inside of a very private matter, family planning, that they have really rigid policies around this, but yet the conversation that sex actually exists doesn't seem to be taking place.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I don't want to completely, slag the Chinese government on this. On one hand, they have made contraception is widely available in China. Anybody who wants to get it can get it. But again, there is this prudishness, this traditional mindset that we don't discuss these things openly. And yet the irony of it all is that when the state feels it has a compelling interest to intrude into the bedroom or, wherever, and that intrusion has been very much saying that you are going to be capped at 1, 2, 3, whatever many children it is right now and will be in the future. So, it's one of these deep ironies that a contemporary China is dealing with on a constant basis.
Well, the new policy changed the role of state family planning apparatus. How do you think this commission that must have tens of thousands of employees are going to change its role in this new policy?
Yeah, that's a great question, because actually China's National Health and Family Planning Commission is a huge bureaucracy, tens of thousands of employees across the country. There's a national department, but then, every province and every major city and even small towns have their own representatives. And the job of this organization for years was literally to police how many children people are having. If they have more children than the quota locally allowed, they would be tracked down and they would be fined. So now this huge apparatus that collected, billions of renminbi in fines, they have to find something else to do. There's been inklings, and there's almost something perverse about this, that they may become involved in childhood development programs, which, when you think about the Family Planning Commission actually having pushed forced abortions for years, the idea that they may actually be helping to set up daycares, is strange, but there is another role. I mean, there has been discussion within NGOs about the National Family Planning Commission actually being involved in family planning consultations. So there have been pilot programs, for example, where women who have had abortions are actually then given sort of a family planning counseling. That would be a great role, because the studies show clearly that if you do intervene and, you know, have conversations about family planning, contraception, it gets used, and you actually keep women from using abortion as contraception. But right now, it's anybody's guess.
I'm wondering, given its reputation, how Chinese feel about this commission in general.
Well, I mean, they're absolutely hated. I mean, it's, you know, there's a lot of government agencies. I mean, you know, Chinese aren't that different from us. We all have government agencies we don't like. But I don't think there is a government agency in China that has a much lower reputation than the Family Planning Commission, you know, on many levels. I mean, the stories of forced abortions are very well known. But the more common complaint are the fines. You know, it makes it very, very difficult to raise a child. And if you can't meet that fine, your child's residence permit could be revoked. So what that would mean is that the child wouldn't have access to public services. Everything from public schooling to health care to, you know, Social Security, whatever that might be, you know, 65 years or 70 years down the line. So, I mean, that combination of policies makes it just an absolutely loathed, loathed agency.
Well, Adam, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Yeah, very happy to be here.
Adam Mintery's written several op-eds about China's new two-child policy. He's an Asia-based correspondent for Bloomberg View. And you can find more, including links to read his articles and find out more on his book, Junkyard Planet, at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. College students, recent college graduates, or those just starting a family are not best known for their expendable income. But the 18 to 30-year-old cohort known as the millennials spends more than $1 trillion a year. And nonprofits and philanthropic organizations are beginning to take note. In an article for the Boston Globe, the young adult novelist and Globe contributor Melissa Shore dives into how charities are strategically cultivating the next generation of givers. Melissa, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So millennials are spending. Are they giving to charities?
Well, I think they are giving, but I think this is something nonprofits are really concerned about. Where are they going to get the next generation of funding? I mean, we all know that this group is strapped with college debt, often underemployed, maybe still living at home on the parents' couch, and they just don't have the money to give right now. One study looked at this and found that millennials only account for about 11% of charitable giving, while baby boomers still make up about 43%. So that's a big gap. But the nonprofits hope that if they develop a relationship now, it'll pay off later when these young adults have the funds to start contributing.
How are they creating those relationships and targeting millennials?
Well, one thing that's become really popular is something called the Young Professional Group. A lot of organizations are founding these. I think it sort of works both ways. The organization gets to tap into a younger social network who maybe recruits some of their friends, and they offer opportunities for the 20-somethings to come and network with each other, and I think they get something out of it too, whether it's making professional, perhaps romantic connections. The activities they organize are very different from your traditional charity gala that the parents may be going to. One fun example is down in the Massachusetts area, Big Brother Big Sister organizes an annual cornhole tournament, so not your traditional charity gala.
So you're talking about how the organizations are targeting them. How is that relationship different than those that charity organizations have cultivated with baby boomers?
Well, I think there's a few huge differences. So one thing that was mentioned to me is that your typical snail mail solicitation, you know, the letter you get in the mail asking for funds, that just doesn't work.
Oh, no, that's a mainstay of public radio, of course.
They're going to have to come up with something new. And, I mean, even take a look at the Muscular Dystrophy Association and its annual Labor Day telethon, which went on for years and we all were raised on. Well, that is discontinued. They have found that that doesn't seem to work anymore. Typical TV ads that we used to run, like for the ASPCA soliciting funds, well, millennials aren't watching TV or they flip the channel. So I think that the best way all these organizations are finding is to tap into social media. And the best example we saw, of course, was last summer's the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge, which the video went viral, and it was a crazy success. So I think anything that millennials can share on social media is huge.
So that means coming up with some sort of scheme that is shareable. I mean, it's not something that a philanthropic organization can base its budget on, certainly.
I mean, mean, it's like catching lightning in a bottle. How do you replicate that success? And even the Ice Bucket Challenge, which was so successful in the summer of 2014, tried it again in 2015, and it didn't really catch on in the same way. I think they raised $100 million the first time around and not so much the second. So everyone is sort of looking for the next big thing. The other thing that millennials tend to do is, you know, they're a little bit dubious of traditional charities, and they're sort of skeptical of how well the money is being spent. If they're going to spend their money, they want to make sure it's a charity that's really using it well. So a lot of them have come up with some innovative ways in starting their own. One charity that's very interesting called Flutter has a organization which will they'll set up a unique experience, and then instead of auctioning it off, they will set up a $10 raffle. So the most you'll have to spend is $10, but all the money pools and there's a winner. And the founder told me that he started this because he felt that a traditional auction is unfair, that it's just not affordable to everyone. And this way, at least everyone gets a chance, but the nonprofit ends up netting the same amount. So innovative ways like that, I think, we're going to see a lot more of those.
Well, you quote in your article, the president of Giving Strong, that's a Portland, Maine social impact consulting firm. And she tells you, unlike earlier generations, millennials tend not to compartmentalize their giving. What does that mean?
That means that they see their giving as part of their lifestyle. So one way is just where they shop. If you look at companies like Warby Parker, the eyeglass company, mm-hmm. they have a policy where they donate one pair of eyeglasses for everyone you purchase. I think millennials are really attracted to companies that have that mission built into what they're purchasing. Another way is on the job. We found that millennials like to work for a company that is going to give them maybe a day of charity work as an organization. And they've even said that was one of their key issues when they were considering where to work and like fielding different job opportunities. That was a key factor they considered, how sociable the company was.
There's a lot of criticism about just, you know, you can just click something easily on Facebook to support it. The charge that this generation of millennials are a bunch of slackers.
Right. I love that term, slacktivism, right? And it's a fair critique, I think. I mean, you're basically saying that, you know, you're retweeting something on social media or you're changing your Facebook avatar to a rainbow and you're supporting marriage equality. But how is that actually affecting change? And, you know, I think let's go back to the Ice Bucket Challenge, right? Because the rule of that was that if you do the challenge, you didn't have to donate. In a sense, it was sort of skirting the actual pay-up model and just putting your video out there for fun instead. And in fact, when they looked afterwards, they found that most people who participated didn't even end up donating. But that challenge did raise over $100 million. And so I think it's fair to say that the campaign had a huge impact. Even if most people were just sharing it, someone was obviously donating, right? So I think, you know, when I talked to the CEO of Massachusetts Nonprofit Network, he was really optimistic that yes, for every 10 people, three of them, you know, will click. But those three will go on to actually doing more than just clicking, that awareness will evolve into action later.
Well, Melissa, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Melissa Shore, she's a novelist and contributor to the Boston Globe, where she wrote What Makes Millennials Give to Charity. You can read the article for yourself. It's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Whether you're looking at charitable giving, political action, or dating, the under 40 set was raised with a decidedly different relationship to technology than their elders. And while millennials may be willing to spend dollars on organizations that have social impact, there are plenty of other goods and services they think ought to come without a price tag at all. Jemiah Parrish of WUNC Youth Radio reports on how a generation of teenagers has learned to text for free.
Jose Diaz is 19 years old and goes to North Carolina Central. He loves his Android but hated the monthly bill. That's why he switched to a Wi-Fi app that allows him to text and talk for free.
Please leave your message after the tone. When done, hang up or press the pound key.
Basically, I've gotten around and found a loophole through the system and was able to benefit from it.
Diaz uses an app called Text Plus, but there are hundreds of them out there. Simone Parker uses one called TextFree. She is a 10th grader in the same boat as Jose Diaz, the no phone plan boat. But she can still text and talk when there is Wi-Fi.
To be honest, I think I'm the smartest out of all, well, not out of all the people, but with the people that, along with the people that has used the app, we're the smartest because, like, all we need to do is, like, go to McDonald's, go home. It doesn't matter. We could be able to text somebody.
Simone Parker and Jose Diaz say Wi-Fi is available just about everywhere they go.
everyone that I'm usually around has Wi-Fi at the house. So that's usually my first question. Like, what's your Wi-Fi password? Restaurants offer it, Starbucks, McDonald's.
They both use smartphones, but you can also make this work with an iPod Touch. That's what middle schooler Melanie Hernandez does.
I just basically use this app called Text Free that, like, you just basically have a number that you choose onto it, and, like, once you get another person's number, you can text or call them or whatever.
One of the downsides of these free services is that with some of them, you have to watch ads to get minutes. The other problem is that you have to be near Wi-Fi.
I don't see it growing.
This is Jason Harris. He works at Verizon Wireless.
I see it being stagnant or kind of going away. As far as domestically, I don't see it growing, no.
But there are a lot of positive reviews in the app stores. And Melanie Hernandez and the other people I talked to seemed happy with it.
You should really get this app because you don't have to pay for anything and it won't cost you anything.
While free is good, it's also far from flawless and has a long way to go. Even the phones we pay for get things wrong sometimes. Text WUNC listeners.
Okay, what do you want to say to WUNC listeners?
For WUNC Youth Radio Institute, I'm Jemiah Parrish.
Your message to WUNC listeners says, for WUNC Youth Media Institute, I'm Jemiah Parrish. Ready to send it?
Really close.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Air travel has changed radically since it first became economically viable to carry many people across long distances in a short amount of time. Today's long lines, security screenings, and cramped conditions contrast sharply with the luxury of mid-century travel. Then people dressed up, spread out, and settled in with a smoke and a good meal. On the upside, it has become much easier to get your concerns addressed, even if you rarely travel, and then travel coach. Martha C. White wrote for the New York Times about how passengers are using social media to complain about air travel, and they are getting a lot of attention. Martha, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Well, so social media seems to have become a new way to communicate with airlines. What are they posting about?
Oh, lots of things. It does tend to be complaints. In some cases, it will be compliments about meals or snacks or the flight itself. In terms of the complaints, what people most often have questions or gripes about will have to do with scheduling, if a plane's delayed or canceled, or the where's my bag tweet is apparently a pretty regular one.
So how many tweets and posts are the airlines, I guess, receiving would be the way to put it, because they can read them if they're tagged?
Yes, it varies. The ballpark tends to be between a few thousand a day, tens of thousand a month. It does depend in some cases how the company decides to define that, if they're just looking at the ones where they're being tweeted at or there's a post on their page, or if it's just a mention.
So how are the airlines responding as they become a little more social media savvy?
Well, they are responding. The number of responses has risen, and they're bringing on additional staff, either cross-training some of their call center personnel to work in social or creating dedicated teams of social, sometimes within the marketing, sometimes under other umbrellas within the company, where these teams are just focused on answering these questions, comments, complaints that come through Facebook and Twitter.
I'm seeing, you know, Delta Airlines, 40 staff members monitor and respond to the tweets. Let's see, where else? Southwest, 29 people. That's a huge staff. How are they actually responding to each individual tweet?
They don't respond to everyone in general. They tend to respond more readily to questions or problems that they can solve. If someone, for instance, has had a flight delayed and is going to miss their connecting flight, they can rebook them on the next one. If someone is having trouble locating a bag, they might be able to point them in the right place or maybe the right carousel. And I think the reason for this is both because they can actually solve those problems as opposed to someone just tweeting, you know, hey, I don't like your airline or something. And when they are able to solve a problem for a customer, then that engenders a sort of goodwill. These very public forums are kind of a double-edged sword for the airlines, in that if they say the wrong thing or if they make the mistake of kind of cutting and pasting a stock answer to everyone, which they try not to do anymore because that really ticks people off, they're able to respond a little more personally, and they're able to solve a problem which generates a goodwill that is sort of outside the scope of your traditional warm and fuzzy advertising campaign.
Now, you quote an executive that you spoke to from a social media analytics company. His thought was that airlines were on a continuous learning curve. What does that mean?
The number of complaints has roughly plateaued, but they're responding more than they have in the past. That, to her, was an indication that there was more of an imperative to talk to these people on social channels and more of a need to create a two-way communication.
What's your thought, though? Are more people complaining in general, or are these people who otherwise might have just, you know, swallowed, grumbled, and accepted their fate tweeting or posting instead?
Oh, absolutely. There are more people complaining. It is about smaller things that otherwise probably wouldn't have risen to the level of outrage needed to type out, print, and mail a letter. I don't know if this is a cultural shift in that we feel more entitled to express our thoughts when we don't get what we want today, or if it's the immediacy of the social channel that fosters this. Probably a combination of both.
Is this a pattern that is showing up in other service industries?
It's certainly showing up in other parts of the travel sector. I spoke with a number of hotel brands who reported a sort of similar story as what we heard from the airlines. I do see it just sort of anecdotally. I see it come up in some other service categories as well. I don't know that it's necessarily limited to service categories. We do see things like apparel manufacturers having a good presence on social media and other types of consumer-facing companies.
Well, obviously, it helps people feel empowered if they have some sort of public channel to express their discontent. Do you think it's going to make any difference in terms of, I don't know, airline policy, pricing? I mean, will it really spur a change?
It depends. There was one incident, and this was a few years back, I want to say. There was a situation on a flight where a gentleman wasn't allowed to bring his folding bike on, even though it was technically within the parameters of the carry-on. So he responded on social media, and the airline did wind up changing its policy in response to that. So they are listening to the extent that it's going to lead to changes in pricing. That might be going a little bit too far, but it's certainly a platform for a dialogue, which I think the brands have been sort of casting about for a way to generate ever since the Web 1.0, and this is the first time they've really been able to achieve it with social channels. So I think it's something that they want to foster, and it's something that they want to encourage, even if they do wind up fielding a lot of gripes.
Well, Martha, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Martha C. White, she's a freelance journalist who wrote for the New York Times about social media's impact on airline customer service. Terrific title, Lost Bags at 140 Characters and Airlines Respond. You'll find a link to read the article at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Biddeford, Maine-based photographer Trent Bell has an impressive client list. He's shot fabulously beautiful buildings and super chic homes around the world, along with enviable interiors and ad campaigns for the likes of Condé Nast Traveler, Dwell, and the New York Times. Well, a few years ago, he started shooting from one of America's least desirable places, a state penitentiary. Trent is speaking at TEDx Amaskeg Milliard, which I'll be hosting this weekend, and is here to talk with us about his project, Reflect, Convicts' Letters to Their Younger Selves. Trent Bell, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So looking through your impressive portfolio, this is the kind of gorgeous, you know, architectural shots and glimpses that people often call design porn. How did you get there?
House porn, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. How did you get there to this, to Reflect?
Well, I started out life, my professional life, with an education in the architectural field, practiced for a few years, realized my attention span was much more well-suited to photography, so naturally went into architectural photography. But I constantly had a nagging in the back of my mind that I wanted to directly give back with the work that I would actually do. Then a while after I became an architectural photographer, I had a friend who was arrested and then facing 36 years in prison. His situation sat on my mind, and then one thing led to another. And so when it came time for me to look into doing something on a personal note, I wanted to focus on something that wasn't quite so along the lines of what I normally shoot, these very designed, very perfect environments. I wanted to focus on something more human, more emotional, something that would create a project that could give back in some way to kind of answer that call in my head that wanted to directly help people with what I was capable of with, mm-hmm. with my talent.
So then came Reflect, Convicts' Letters to Their Younger Selves. Describe the project, you know, sort of how it looks and...
Well, the look of the project is a very painterly light, if you want to think of it like that. The inspiration was taken from more of an interrogation light where there'd be an overhead single light source, but it's not, a direct take from that. It's a very reverent but somewhat haunting light. It's very, very singular and it brings you right to the person's eyes, right to the person, and everything else falls off. But then ensconced around each individual image, each portrait, is this handwritten letter that the inmates each wrote to their younger self to kind of send back wisdom and to keep it with just in the look. That is the look of mm-hmm. the images. They're very haunting and reflective in quality.
I didn't see them. I only saw them online, but I did see a short video of them in a gallery. They look almost life-size. I mean,
they're a little larger than life-size, probably, yeah. Uh-huh.
So what was behind this inspiration for you, the letter to the younger self with the portrait?
Well, when we came up with the idea of, first of all, doing a personal project, and then my thought was to do portraits of prison inmates just because my friend's situation had been on my mind for quite some time. We liked that idea, but we just knew we wanted the project to go deeper than just an appearance. In a very subtle way, you can pull a lot out of a portrait, but we wanted it to go a good distance beyond that. We wanted to have a lot more of a collaboration between artist and subject. We wanted more and more story in there, even though it's a single frame. And we saw this as a way of the subject really contributing to that end result. And especially since it's in their personal handwriting, it adds this, you know, artistic touch, this personal effect to each portrait. It has their style of writing in it, not just their
words.
Some very
florid, them in particular.
Yeah,
that I'm
Khalil.
His
writing is just incredible. And then others are much more jagged, but then, you know, there's that touch of their personality mm-hmm. in each of them, which is really great to see.
Now, obviously, to do something like this, you're dealing with a penal system, a bureaucracy. Tell me a little bit about the process. Did you know who you were going to shoot when you went to the prison to shoot?
We really lucked out. They had, I believe, a PR person join the administration. And they said this would be, you know, first of all, a great thing for the inmates to process their experience. Mm. And so the wheels were really greased for getting access and everything else. It fell in the lap of a social worker that we worked through that really liked the idea. We had a couple hang-ups with the bureaucracy when we actually went to do the shoot. When we got there, there had been a slight administrative change. And we got to the front doors the day of the final shoot, and they said, you're not coming in unless you can produce an email before this specific date. And there's not real good cell service around prisons, as you might imagine. And so we had to scramble and everything else. But we found an email that just snuck under the date, and then there was these issues of not being able to wear shorts in. This was in the middle of the summer when we did the shoot. So we had to send my studio manager off to go get pants. The bureaucracy, that was about all we had really for hang-ups. A lot of the hang-ups that came were just from our own misconceptions of what we were expecting or how we were expecting the the general population to respond to our call to participate. We thought there'd be a lot more people, a lot more inmates that would love to participate when we only ended up with the 12 that we have. So that was...
So they were all self-selecting. They came forward.
These are the only 12 that wanted to participate, to our knowledge.
That is a little shocking.
Yeah. The thing that we had assumed at the time, we had assumed if we were in prison, taking our own experience and putting it just behind the walls, we thought we'd want to do anything to get our mind outside of the walls to break the monotony. But the mistake we made there is that we were assuming our life experience onto an individual that did not have the same life experience, the same parents, financial situation, relationships, everything else. It was a completely different person. I think it's a huge life lesson that I've taken away from this. We assumed our position just immediately putting us in prison and then assuming what our actions would be and how we would react. So we just expected them to react like we would think we would react just being behind those walls, where it's so much more than that. It's far deeper. What we were really asking those guys to do was to make themselves vulnerable, which is not safe in prison. And we were asking them to relive a time when they were free, to put themselves back in that time when they could have avoided becoming, incarcerated. And so that's a painful process, to look introspectively and to make themselves vulnerable and go down that path and relive it and have to put it into a letter to guide their younger self, which is impossible. But we did this whole project initially not looking to benefit as much the inmates as much as youths that might find themselves in the inmates' situation in the future. But it ended up really benefiting the inmates through the process of just the very difficult introspection and processing of their story and sharing it. The process of sharing was very healing for them.
Have you ever seen that series or television show, Scared Straight?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. So it is these prisoners. They've got rooms full of young kids, school kids, and they're telling them, like, prison is not great. I mean, they're basically warning them.
Yeah.
And they're explosive, and they're sort of shocking.
Yeah.
It struck me how different it is when writing to one's self.
Yeah. When you mention that, the thing that comes to mind is, what is more effective at creating behavior? Is it fear of something that might happen, or something that you've been inspired, something that you're wanting to do? And when you look at the penal system of, well, we have to be really tough so it'll prevent crime, no one decides that they're going to not kill someone in a fit of passion because of the, possible effects. They think, I'll get away with it or whatever. What we're trying to do is inspire people straight, not scare them straight. And I think it has a much, much further reaching effect when you inspire someone rather than when you scare them. Courage can overcome fear. What overcomes inspiration,
What would you say to your younger self? Well, Trent Bell has been doing a fascinating project. It's called Reflect: Convicts' Letters to Their Younger Selves. He went into a Maine state penitentiary and took photographs of prisoners and produced them with letters from their current selves to their younger selves, giving words of caution and encouragement, and oftentimes pain and regret. It is just a fascinating collection to read. One begins, "To my younger, foolish me." Another says, "I want to reach out to you and hopefully help save you from becoming me." There's certainly a theme of regret. There are a lot of sort of like bad choices. Any other things that you noticed that came through very strongly to you?
A reoccurring theme over and over in each one of the letters was listen to the people that love you, your family.
Huh.
Avoid the drugs and alcohol, and be careful who you choose for friends. These are all, their mother could have written these letters.
That's one thing that really struck me, that they're not so much just reflections, but there's kind of a counsel in there.
Oh, absolutely.
And it feels, to me, it feels fatherly or maybe motherly, definitely paternal. But clearly they were told these things, probably. They just weren't ready to hear them.
Yeah. There's so many different situations of how a person can end up wherever they're at. This whole experience has really opened my mind much more so to the nature versus nurture argument. And, you know, the thing I've come away with is that each one of these men, really, they're not aliens cut from a different cloth. And I could have ended up in any of their situation given if I had not maybe had the same financial or love backing from my parents and my extended family, you know. And it really makes you step back and approach people differently that are in this situation with a lot more empathy, a lot more consideration of, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. It makes you respond to people differently. It makes you think a little bit more before you react. And I saw that also in our assumption of, oh, the whole prison population is going to want to take part in this great project. And only 12 guys were really like, okay, I can do this. I think I can do this. And one guy, the day of the shoot, still hadn't committed. He still hadn't really finished his letter, and he didn't know if he wanted to put himself out there. Mm. I mean, we're asking these guys to share, you know, a huge failure. But at the same time, we learn so much from failure. And we take these men and we lock them up and we throw away the key and we want to forget about them. Our American culture of how we deal with offenders in any way, shape, or form is very much just punish them, but don't, you know, don't educate them, don't gear them up for rejoining our society.
Well, there is a lot of political will in that direction, right? There are a lot of people who say, lock them up and throw away the key. You know, being tough on crime is the best way to be. And I wondered, when you put these out there, you know, not just on your website, but you had gallery shows. There's been a lot of attention. I saw something in the London Daily Mail or some UK Independent, something like that. So getting a lot of attention on this. But have people come back to you and said, you know, why are you glorifying these criminals? Why are you giving them airtime?
On one or two of the first things where it was picked up online, I started to read comments after the article. And I learned very quickly not to ever do that again, just because, you know, the not having any accountability and just being able to throw mud, there's just antagonists. And but yeah, there has been there's been everything from why are you taking advantage of these men and making them relive this again to why are you glorifying them? Why aren't you focusing on the victims? We chose to focus on this one thing because of an experience that a friend of mine has had, and this is the first thing that we've done. It's not that we've chosen to avoid focusing on victims. We just chose we want to explore this, and so that's what we did. And we're not avoiding anything else in any way. It's just the first step in what we've done, and I would very much like to, you know, expand this project even further to maybe get the same type of treatment, but around possibly the victims that are still alive that might have been associated with some of these men. So, you know, there's two sides to every coin, and we definitely want to explore those. It's just time and money at this point.
Right. And in fact, you're trying to make a documentary film about this. Is that correct?
Yes.
And we're a little tied up in money right now.
Yeah. I make my living as a commercial photographer, focusing primarily on architecture. And this is a personal project for me, completely funded by me. There was sponsors that helped with the printing and the gallery and everything else that, you know, we're very appreciative of. But yeah, to continue the project on, we're going to be looking probably to put together a Kickstarter campaign and find some funding to expand this and, you know, follow up on this, but also expand this treatment into other aspects of human existence. You know, parents that have lost children, veterans that have seen active duty, you know, people that have won the lottery, everything from the most common joys of life to the worst sorrows of life. We want to use this project and this treatment to, you know, capture that experience through introspection and then storytelling and then finally in art to present that to viewers to help inform and balance people's lives.
Well, Trent, thank you so much for coming in to talk with us about it.
Absolutely.
Trent Bell, he is a commercial photographer and also the artist behind Reflect, Convicts' Letters to Their Younger Selves. He's going to be speaking at TEDx Amiskeg Milliard this weekend about that project. I'm going to be hosting it. The show is sold out, but there are a number of viewing parties and other opportunities to watch it online. If you need more on that and a link to Trent's website where you can see some of these fantastic and somewhat haunting portraits, that's all at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org, or you can search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please rate it in iTunes. That'll help others find it. And as we know, the best surprises and ideas travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio.